In the last week, Hindu mobs have burnt, killed and destroyed Muslims and Muslim property. Dozens of people have been killed, more than hundreds injured. The mobs, with the aid of the Indian government, have burnt mosques and schools, shops and homes. Journalists have been attacked. All the while, the institutions of our democracy, the legislature, the judiciary, the executive and the press, show token regard for the lives of people who've been killed. In this context, what does it mean to be Indian? What is our national identity? What if we hate and carry violence out against each other repeatedly? What are our national values? Welcome to States of Anarchy, a podcast on global affairs and foreign policy. I'm your host, Hamsini Hariharan. Mahatma Gandhi once said, "A nation is happy that has no history." But we do have a long history, one that is characterized by non-violence and the struggle for freedom and the values of our constitution. But we also have divisions in our society, and they are cemented now more than ever before. So what does it mean to be Indian? How do constitutional values shape our national identity? Is India always going to be riddled with communal violence and the targeting of people based on religion? My guest for today is Manali Kumar. Manali is a non-resident postdoctoral researcher with the Institute of Political Science at the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland. She has a PhD in political science from the National University of Singapore. Her research focuses on foreign policy decision-making under uncertainty and India's national identity and role as a rising power. We'll get to the conversation with Manali after a short break. Hi, Manali. Welcome to States of Anarchy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here, Hamsini. I'm really looking forward to this.
All right. So let's dive straight in. Benedict Anderson says that the nation is an imagined community, right? So what is national identity then if a nation is imagined?
Right. So I'll start by just briefly, you know, talking about identities more generally, right? Mm. So identities are categories in terms of which we think about ourselves. So each of us have a whole bunch of identities that together tell us, well, who am I? What does it mean to be me and go about in this world? And so this idea of national identities builds on this concept of individuals' identities. And so we understand this idea of national identity as what does it mean to be a country? Right? Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to be India? And what does it mean to be Indian? And it's imagined in the sense of, you know, I mean, India did not exist since time immemorial. Countries in this world in general, they all have very specific histories and over time in which they came to exist as the political territorial entities that they are today. Mm. And so, you know, there are a whole bunch of different categories that together comprise of what does it mean to be India. And these ideas come from within our society. They come from ideas that people already have about, you know, what country they live in, what kind of country they want to live in. And they're, you know, very often political leaders, national leaders play a very important role in putting all of these discourses together and communicating certain ideas of what does it mean to be Indian. And so, you know, if we speeches of leaders, how they talk about India and what the goals of this country are, or, you know, textbooks tell us, history books and social science books. And I remember, you know, being in school and when we learn things about, you know, our national flag and our national symbol and, you know, our fundamental rights and duties and how to be a good citizen. You know, we, our society is always constructing itself in a certain way. And together, these discourses help us understand what a nation is.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I was remembering, I think a couple of years ago, it's been a while, but there was the release of the Silent National Anthem. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's the Indian National Anthem in sign language. Uh-huh. And I think when I saw it, and a lot of people who also saw it just felt very sort of emotional right. in watching it. And yeah. I think it's that sort of feeling that you get when you yes. sort of like belong to something.
The sense of belonging. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you said, it's made up of lots of different sort of identities, right? You could have a caste identity
yes.
or a communal identity
Correct.
Or a political identity, yeah. depending on like what label you want to subscribe to,
yeah.
if you want to subscribe to something
Absolutely.
At all.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of this also happens in terms of other groups, right? So within society, you might sort of formulate your identity as a Punjabi as different from, you know, neighboring groups like Haryanvis mm-hmm. or, you know, what Tamilians are. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, when we talk about what does it mean to be Hindu, we often talk about it in terms of how is it different from being Christian or Muslim. Mm-hmm. So in the same way, like countries also think about themselves, how they are like and unlike other countries as well. So, you know, we might, in India, of course, we define ourselves very specifically as different from Pakistan. Like that's very, very strong in how India understands itself as well.
Yeah, and I think like for smaller countries around India, that's also a big part of their identity.
Right.
They're Sri Lankan because they're not Indian.
Yes.
They're Nepali because they're not Sri Lankan.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important part of saying, oh, my identity is distinct and
yeah.
it's unique and
yes.
it has its own historical, cultural Absolutely. Significance.
And so then these identities sort of, you know, become part of the reason for why this country must exist and, you know, mm-hmm. why we must protect our way of life and why we must defend our national self against other, you know, ideas or other ways of life. And that's something that's, you know, very important, I think, in Indian politics at the moment, especially.
Yeah, completely agree. So Sunil Kilnani, in his book, The Idea of India, also talks about how a singular Indian identity is very difficult to pin
right.
down, right? Apart from sort of your constructed national symbols and
right.
things like that. As you mentioned, like being Punjabi or being Tamilian, your sub-national identities are very, very important. And so I think that's what makes the Indian national identity so dynamic. It's
yeah.
the idea that we're always straddling multiple identities at some point in time.
And absolutely. I remember, you know, what I was raised on throughout my entire time in school in India was unity and diversity.
Mm.
Right? That's why we should be proud of India, because we're a melting pot. And we always had such a great sense of pride in the so many different languages that we have and religions and different cultures. And they just, you know, the sheer diversity that it adds to our own lived experience. And, you know, I mean, food and music and art in India is so diverse precisely because we have so many different cultures mm-hmm. that form, you know, what India is.
Yeah. Whenever I'm outside India, particularly when I'm in China,
mm-hmm.
I get asked this a lot. They say, oh, is it really true that you have so many different languages?
Yes.
And I say, you know, sometimes if you travel for 100 kilometers, it changes.
It does.
Right? 50 kilometers, your dialects change
Absolutely.
Fundamentally to the point that they could be completely different languages.
Yeah.
And that's what's really interesting, and that's what made me proud of when I was a kid as well, this idea that we were all diverse but we were all equal, and that's what made us Indian in a
Absolutely.
Sense.
Absolutely. And you know, I think and this, we can get to this in more detail when we talk about what we find in the project, but this equality is something that is such an important part of how India sees itself.
Mm.
That, you know, we have all these different groups of people, and yet, you know, we're all equally Indian.
Mm.
This is really something that has been a very, very strong part of what it means to be India and Indian.
So when we're talking about all these different things, it makes me wonder, what constructs identity? Is this about how Indians perceive themselves? Is it sort of relational in that how Indians perceive others? Is it about how others perceive Indians? So how do you sort of construct an identity?
So theoretically, all of this plays a part in how an identity is constructed. Identities are fundamentally relational, right? So a very common way of thinking about it is the master-slave dynamic, that in order for one person to be the master, there has to be somebody else who's the slave.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, identities are always relational in that sense. And when we talk about national identity, they're relational in two ways, right? So they're relational in terms of groups within the self as well, which is very important in, I would say, especially important in a multicultural, diverse society. Mm. And they're also relational in terms of external others, right? So those who are not part of the national self. And so we see when we look at discourses of how we talk about, you know, what it means to be India or Indian or other countries, how they talk about their identities, we're always talking about it in terms of groups within the self and those who are outside the self. Mm.
That's very interesting. So you mentioned this earlier, but you're working on a project about Indian national identity, right? Could you tell me a little bit more about it? Because when we're talking about these nebulous things, right, about identities that are so sort of personal to us, how do you quantify such a thing?
So I'll start by telling you about the project. It's called the Making Identity Count Project, and it's run by three scholars, academics, Ted Hoff, who's a professor at National University of Singapore, Bentley Allen, who's at Johns Hopkins University in the US, and Sarjan Vucetic, who's at the University of Ottawa in Canada. And what they've done is they've put together a network of scholars working at universities across the world. And we're building a national identity database of 10 major countries from 1950 to 2010. And so it is many, many, many people involved. And I'm working on India with my colleague Amit Julka. We're co-editors of the India data set. And, you know, we have similar reports on the project website covering the identity discourses of other countries. So there's US, China, UK, France, Russia. So there's 10 different countries. So how do we build this data set, right? So we're using this method called discourse analysis, in which analysts have been trained to study a standardized sample of texts. Right, so we study different kinds of texts, speeches by political leaders, especially the prime minister and the president, for instance, history textbooks for schools, especially at, you know, about the class 8 to 10 in India, because, you know, we have the streaming and not everybody reads history. But the way in which, you know, we talk about Indian history, you know, how are we teaching Indians about our past, that's a very important way in which the national self is constructed. So we look at that. We also look at wider public discourses in newspapers, so newspaper editorials and letters to the editor. This is an important conversation that we look at. And then we look at cultural representations in best-selling novels and blockbuster movies. So the idea is not so much to go and ask people, what is your national identity, but rather to, you know, to follow the interpretivist ideal and to try and overhear how people talk about India and being Indian when they're not, there's no expectation of, you know, being pinpointed about those things.
That's very interesting. So do you sort of use the same variables across different countries? So, for example, in China or Brazil or Russia or any of the other 10 countries, would you use the same sort of factors, leader speeches, movies, books, and so on?
Right. So we use the same kind of texts, right, with some differences for, you know, to account for what the differences are in how each country is set up. But I think one big difference in how we do this research is usually, you know, you make a list of what categories of identity you're looking for, and then you read the documents and you code for those things. That's a very deductive way of doing this analysis. We don't do that. We do it inductively.
Okay.
So how we do it is we take a speech, for instance, and we read the speech, and every time we read something, we think about, well, does it say something about what India is, what does it mean to be Indian, right? So it's an inductive approach where we're not looking for certain things, but we're letting these subjects and we're letting these texts speak for themselves. And then we're looking for, okay, out of all of this, what are the categories that are emerging? What are the discourses that are emerging? So instead of a top-down, we're doing a very, very bottom-up approach. And so what happens is that, you know, sometimes you find very surprising things that, you know, you may not have expected, but it keeps open the potential for discovery.
Mm. Okay, that's very interesting. So I want to know, what are the surprising things that you've found? So I know that you have this data between 1950 and 2010.
Correct.
So what are sort of like broad narratives? What are broad continuous things or disruptions that you see within this data?
Sure. So I'll talk about it in terms of broad continuities and changes first. And what we notice is, you know, four very broad continuities over this entire period. The first thing is that India has since 1950 always identified itself very strongly as an independent democratic society that constitutionally guarantees freedoms and liberties to its citizens, right? So independent, democracy, freedom, liberty, and constitution. These are just core aspects of India's identity since 1950. And these are very, very positive identities. These are things that India takes pride in about itself. And the emphasis on constitution and fundamental rights is something that comes up very frequently in the Indian public discourse. The fact that we have a constitution is itself, you know, a matter of great pride. The fact that this constitution then establishes certain separation of powers, that is very, very important. And it's understood as something that is an essential cornerstone of our democracy. Mm-hmm. And then also what is a matter of pride is that our constitution guarantees freedoms to citizenship. Mm-hmm. And specifically, what is really important to people is the right to equality. Mm-hmm. And what is also what comes up, I think, in every single year's report, we see secularism is distinctly important as an identity that is established by the Constitution. So this is, you know, a very, very great continuity that we found.
That's very interesting. Just for a minute, I want to discuss the Constitution. And I think it's great that it's evident that it's sort of part of the Indian national identity, because the Constitution is sort of this far-reaching document which sort of envisions a social revolution, right? It puts down norms and ideas that are sort of very unheard of in the Indian subcontinent, possibly the world at that point in time. So, and I think that's one of the reasons maybe that India prides itself on being all those other things.
Absolutely.
Independent, democracy, republic.
Yes.
And I think this percolates down to citizens, whether or not they know it, in very basic ways.
I think in a very basic way, people do know it. And I think it comes from, you know, the fact that we had to fight very hard for our independence. Mm-hmm. And that's something people still remember. I think it's reducing a little bit because it's been a few generations. But this fact that, you know, we had to fight very, very hard for Azadi. That is something that is still very much part of the Indian imagination. And that is part of, you know, why independence and freedom are such important parts of our identity, that after, you know, being subjugated and exploited by British colonialism for so long, that we're finally, you know, we are equal in the community of states. This is definitely a very important part of.
Yeah, because like this is when like Nehru's like words at midnight, right? India awakens to freedom.
Yes.
I think that's just beautiful. And I agree, there's sort of a national memory. Maybe it is sort of less present now, but perhaps because I think even my generation, our grandparents were people who were involved actively in the freedom movement. And so you sort of have that national memory. You sort of have people who undergone partition.
Yes.
And this idea that Indian freedom came after a non-violent struggle, which took a very long time, are all ideals that are embedded in sort of your national consciousness.
Absolutely. And, you know, this the non-violent and peaceful is also an identity category that emerges in our research in almost every single year. What's interesting is this is something that our political leaders talk about more frequently. And they very often talk about this as something that guides our foreign relations, and mm-hmm. something, you know, that guides how we, what contribution we want to make to the international system mm-hmm. more generally, that, you know, India believes that conflicts should always be resolved with mutual dialogue mm-hmm. and, you know, through peaceful ways mm-hmm. and the Gandhian ideal of nonviolence. It's something that our leaders always talk about, at least instrumentally.
So political rhetoric.
Absolutely. And sometimes one wonders how seriously they take it when you look at what's happening within the country.
Of course. I think that's the thing about political rhetoric, right? It remains rhetoric unless there is something to back it up.
Yeah.
So what are other things that you find within your data?
So the second important continuity that we find is a concern with the divisions in Indian society. Mm-hmm. And there are many, right? Mm-hmm. Caste divisions, there's regional and linguistic. Mm-hmm. But again, the most important division that India focuses on is the communal division. Mm-hmm. And there's broad consensus in Indian society that there is a lot of communalism, but also that communalism is bad. Mm. That, you know, we have to do everything that we can to reduce communalism mm. in our society and our politics. The third continuity is a concern with India's economic status.
Okay.
The fact that we are a developing economy with persistent poverty. Mm. This is something that has been a constant theme in India's national identities. The discourse here has changed a little bit.
Okay.
In the earlier decades, you know, in the 1950s, 70s even, this was understood much more as a sense of economic weakness due to exploitation during colonial times. And after the 70s, a little bit of transition in terms of focusing on some of the progress that has been made in industry and agriculture in India. But on the whole, the need for economic growth and especially inclusive economic growth is very, very important. And here, you know, again, this concern with equality in India, which, you know, we always talk about again in terms of the constitutionally established value that everybody is equal. Mm. We want that to translate into the kind of economic growth that we have in the country. And this is really, very noticeable in how the Indian public talks about this, that we want redistribution of wealth, right? We want to have reduce the inequality, rural and urban disparities in the country. So this is sort of a third very, very important theme. And finally, the fourth most visibly continuous theme in India's national identity discourses is a disillusionment with Indian politics. Mm. And what was surprising for me was, you know, to find this particular aspect in the 1950 report, you know, which is the Republic has just been founded. Mm. We're just, you know, a couple of years after independence. And already there is such a deep sense of cynicism and disillusionment with India's political leadership because, you know, they're corrupt and they're inefficient. Mm. And this is not something that is acknowledged by the governing elite very often. Mm. They don't address it head on. They don't talk about the corruption. Mm. But in the newspaper conversations and in the mass discourses, even in the movies, especially of the earlier times, if you look at it, this is just such a common theme that it's very surprising to me, at least.
No, it's very understandable, that disillusionment, because I feel it now. And so I can imagine in the 1950s, when it's immediately after independence, when I guess you're just expecting tangible change, right? You say, okay, we've gotten independence, but what do you sort of do with that independence?
Right.
And I guess the government at that point in time, if you look at the backdrop of all the things that are happening and all the things that they're dealing with, partition, the consolidation of states, a war with Pakistan, all of these things, and I can understand why, as a citizen who is illiterate, who doesn't have access to a lot of different avenues to reach to the government, why you would be disillusioned.
Yeah, I guess, you know, personally, I was expecting a sort of that, you know, we've won independence. Now, let's get about building this country and, you know, let's make India great. And we know it'll be a struggle, but, you know, let's put up a good fight. I was just surprised to not find that sense so much. And, you know, you look at the reports and it's just year after year after year, it's just disillusionment and, you know, very, very, a lot of pessimism about the future of the country. Mm. And so for me, that was a bit surprising. But we also have, you know, we observe some changes. Mm. And talking about this pessimism, the one very noticeable change is that after 2010, India talks about itself in much more optimistic terms.
Ah, okay.
And again, that's not surprising if you think about what's happening in the country, right? In the previous couple of decades had been marked by a lot of economic growth, for instance, mm-hmm. especially after liberalization. India's growth story takes off. And then in the entire 2000s decade, we had this great India shining narrative mm-hmm. that, of course, our government did a very great job of pushing forward. And so, you know, after all of that, finally, in 2010, we get a sense that, yeah, India's, you know, India's growing. It is a vibrant country. We start talking about Indians in terms of being talented and mm-hmm. being skilled, and we're educated, and, you know, we're making technological advancements. We start talking about India as an IT powerhouse. Mm-hmm. So this is a very interesting change that happens visibly from 2010. Mm-hmm. And the other one, you know, we notice that a new identity gets added. Mm-hmm. And this is when India starts talking about itself as a rising power. Mm-hmm. And so what we see is that it's not just, you know, the political leaders who are talking about India as a great moral force in the mm-hmm. world, which, of course, all Indian political leaders have mm-hmm. done, you know, since independence. But this is something that's beginning to seep into the everyday man's imagination mm-hmm. about India and India's place in the world. And so that's interesting.
Yeah, I was just remembering this. I mean, it seems very ironical now, but I remember our former president, APJ Abdul Kalam, wrote a book that would say that India would be a superpower yeah. by 2020. Yeah. And a lot of people said, yeah, it's yeah. very possible that
Absolutely.
We could be a superpower by 2020, yeah. right? Whether or not we're there is a question for a whole different podcast. But yeah, I can see that optimism sort of coming in, right?
Absolutely.
Because suddenly you have India being a huge market.
Yes.
And the idea that suddenly you have a middle class with a disposable income,
yeah.
right? And education levels are higher.
Correct.
And you would think that your quality of life is generally better.
Absolutely.
So I can see why there's sort of this optimism of India
yeah.
being a rising power.
Yeah.
And also like the idea that India suddenly is part of like new multilaterals.
Right.
Right. And it's no longer just this large, poor country.
Right. No longer trapped with the Hindu rate of growth, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think after, you know, 2008 financial crisis in the US also made a difference because emerging markets, India and China, played a big role in the economic recovery at that time. So that also helped. But, you know, associated with this change, there was another change that we noticed, which is not so much new identities, but some of the more constant discourses dropping out.
Such as?
And that was, you know, this earlier decades, there was a much more pronounced concern with the rural-urban disparities in India. Mm. And this is very, very noticeable in the more the mass discourses that we look at in movies and in novels. Mm. And so if you ever watched movies from the 70s or the 80s, and if you remember the common themes in the movies, you know, there was always this guy from the village who has to leave and move to the city. This was a very common theme. And so we talk about people from the village as living these simple, honest lives. They're very hardworking people. Mm. And then he's come to the big city.
Where the city is filled with vice and...
Lots of vice, right? Like so modern and westernized, but these people don't have values. Mm. And there's some, of course, like, you know, themes that are quite particular to that time in Indian history when movies in the 70s and 80s, there's a concern with smuggling, for instance, right? Which was very common in licensed Raj India. This was a very, very big problem. But the underlying discourse in this was to sort of highlight, you know, the challenges that people in the villages are facing and also the challenges that the urban poor face. Mm. And this is something, this discourse about highlighting the struggles of the poor, the rural-urban disparity, the struggles of the farmer, you know, this has just completely disappeared from our mainstream imagination of India. So if we look at movies, you know, since the 2000s. Mm. It's much more the aspirations of India, of young India, you know, as being in New York or in London and in Paris. So that's become the imagination of India. And we've sort of, you know, lost touch with the poverty and the struggle that so many more millions face in this country.
Yeah, and I guess since the 2000s, if there are films broadly in mainstream media about villages, then it's sort of like this idyllic village narrative, yeah, right? Like how you have it in Swadesh.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting, I think, change to think of. Yeah, because then, like, you have this narrative between, oh, there's a Bharat and there is in India, and how do you sort of move between the two?
Yeah. As you know, we've also stopped talking about the criminality in Indian society as much, I feel. Like in movies, you know, in the 70s, 80s, 90s even, violence against women was a very, very important topic. Mm. Theft and smuggling and gang politics, like all of these things were addressed much more commonly in Indian cinema, which I think these days we don't talk about this as much. Like even about when it comes to violence against women, it has become, you know, it's more subtle violence. I feel we still see that women are being portrayed in more subservient ways in a lot of the popular movies, the blockbuster movies. But that's not as much as a, you know, reflection of still how ingrained prejudice against women is in Indian society.
Yeah. And I think actually if you go to a different indicator, which I'm not sure you've looked at in your data, but if you look at TV shows, for example, I actually think TV shows maybe perhaps in the 70s, 80s and 90s on, say, Doordarshan or otherwise were a lot more, they were meant to be educational.
Yes.
And therefore, a lot of them were progressive in that sense, even if they did carry a lot of like societal baggage and all of
that. Absolutely.
Because if you comparatively look at the trash that is now television in India.
Yeah, I think my colleague Amit is watching some TV serials for one of his reports, for sure. You know, the other thing I noticed is also lack of diversity in contemporary Indian TV and cinema. And this is, if you, you know, again, like going back to the 70s and the 80s, you see characters still, you know, you'll see Christian and Parsi characters. Mm. And of course, they were stereotyped. You know, like the Christian uncle will always be a drunkard and the Parsi couple will always be this, you know, they don't really know what is going on. They're a little bit silly, but they're very, very kind. And you'll have the Kabuliwala Afghan character. Mm. So they were stereotyped, and of course we treated them in a prejudiced manner, but they were there, right? And when was the last time you saw a character like this on Indian TV, right?
Who was not like a yoga name,
yeah,
or like morally corrupt, like party person,
right?
Like, you know, like if they're urban or, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I guess those prejudices have definitely changed. And if you look at diversity, I was just thinking of like the Shyam Benegal films, the early ones in the 70s and the 80s. And a lot of them were shot in Dakhni, which I can't imagine happening, to be honest, if it's not sort of like, if it doesn't have a regional focus anymore. So those are very interesting trends. What else do you have under your changes?
I think these are some of, you know, the broad changes. There is, you know, this overall shift in India where we're just talking about ourselves in more positive terms. So earlier there was just a lot more pessimism and a focus on all the negative things about India and we have to get rid of these things. Whereas now we're still talking about the same problems, but we're talking about them in slightly more positive terms, more aspirational terms. Mm. So I think on the whole, you know, talking about the national psyche, if there is such a thing, like maybe there is some benefit to having a more positive outlook.
Mm. So let's go back a little bit, back to the 1950s, when we're talking about sort of the constitution, and you said people were sort of disillusioned with the corruption and with the inefficiency of the politicians. What are other trends that you see in the 1950s?
And there's also definitely, you know, there is a pessimism about all of that, but there is also a cautious optimism.
Mm.
And people are, you know, certainly very, very proud of the fact that we've won this independence and we've passed our own constitution, which is a huge achievement. And we're embarking on a mission to become a modern scientific nation.
Mm.
And so, you know, we aspire to build a society which is educated.
Mm.
We want to build a society that is scientific. We want to get rid of all the superstitions that are so rampant in Indian society at the time. We're also very, very deeply concerned about the weaknesses of Indian society, and we want to change that.
Mm.
Want to, you know, really make society gender equal and caste equal and make it secular, deal with all the internal divisions, and try and deal with the trauma of partition. Mm. So it is, you know, there is disillusionment, but there is also a sense of, you know, there's a lot of work that we have to do. Mm. And we need to do it to become a certain kind of country.
Mm. And I'm just wondering, when we're talking about national identity, I can't help but at this point in time, the national identity is very nascent, right? Like if I'm a person in, say, like Tamil Nadu, yeah, or one of the states in the Northeast, then my idea of being Indian would have been very different. Sort of, and that's when you have sort of the anti-Hindi riots, yeah, for example, in the South. And you have the start of regional political parties that, yeah, comes up. So how do these things sort of figure out in a national identity?
Yeah, you know, I mean, theoretically, of course, all of that is part of national identity. And we see the consequences of that in how Indian politics has evolved over the years. The challenge of, you know, the kind of study that we've done in a multilinguistic society like India is that, you know, I think it's super interesting to go and study these different imaginations, mm-hmm, of what is India and what does it mean to be Indian in different languages. For the first cut of this project, the data set that we have right now, we only look at primarily English language, mm, sources. And of course, you know, we have to make a start somewhere. Mm. Yeah. And so we started with English because, again, like this is the only common language that we have, mm, for the whole country, right? Mm. Since we don't have one national language. Mm. And so we're not able to capture some of these differences in how, mm, different parts of the country thinks about itself. Mm. You know, our hope is that maybe we'll be able to run a project in India which will capture these linguistic differences, rather differences in national imagination, mm, among speakers of different language. Mm. And that will, of course, help us try to, I think it will help us understand the ideational roots, mm, of a lot of these persistent disputes that we have in, mm, India. And as you rightly pointed out, language politics is a very big part, right? Mm. Even today, one big division in our country is this perception, which is borne out by policy as well, of the Hindi-speaking government in the center trying to impose its policies and its vision of India on other parts of the country.
Yeah, I think, you know, I hope that your study does evolve where you can do that, because for me, it's very interesting that around people my age or people who are younger, right, they learn about partition, but it's so surgical, because, yeah, they don't know anyone who's undergone the trauma, yeah, of it. And so it's very far from them. And, yeah, so this new identity of this sort of southern identity, yeah, if I might call it so, is very interesting for me to see.
Yeah.
As someone who's like, oh, like I do not speak Hindi, and I'm proud, right, of the fact that I don't speak Hindi, and why should I?
Yeah.
And those sort of factors, I think, would be interesting in the future to study, to see how they stood at 1950.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
So let's move on a little bit. What happens, say, 20 years ahead when we move on to the 1970s?
So surprisingly, things get even more pessimistic, if that's possible. And actually, by 1970, we're in the situation where if you read, you know, the discourses, you get a sense that democracy is in danger, mm, that there is still a very clear sense of pride that India is an independent democracy that guarantees freedoms to its citizens. And there is optimism about some improvements that have been made in education and industry, for sure. But there is a very, very strong consensus that Indian politics is in a state of turmoil, and the people are struggling due to poverty, and communal politics and violence are important causes of insecurity already at that time. And all of this coalesces around this sense that our political leaders no longer have the moral and ethical character, mm, that you need from people who are running the country, mm, that they are interested more in their own power politics and making sure that they can retain their seat in power, as opposed to remembering that their job is to serve the nation and, mm, to serve the people. And so, you know, we see this very, very openly in not only the newspaper discourses at this time, where they're like, you know, people are writing in to in letters to the editor, or like, remember the time of our freedom fighters who were giving up everything in the service of the nation, and look at the kinds of politicians we have now. All that they are interested in doing is exploiting divisions, caste divisions, and communal divisions, and they'll do anything to make sure that they're in power, but they're not addressing the issues that everyday people are struggling with in their lives. And so again, like this sense of disillusionment with politicians, with the inefficiency of our bureaucracy, the ineffectiveness of the government, is reached a point where people are just not sure about, you know, how democratic are we then? You know, so there is just more pessimism by this time. And this is something that, you know, becomes more sharp in 1990, because that's a time where terrorism and separatist movements, you know, throughout the 80s, and this is post-emergency as well. And so people are just, you know, consumed. Like, India is consumed with all of this violence and all of this division. And we're still holding on to, you know, taking pride in our, you know, constitutional values. Like, we're still proud that we are a democracy. We still value our secularism. And we're, you know, we take pride in our ancient civilizational past. But if we look at, you know, what are the top 5 or 10 most important identities for India, like 70s, 90s, it's still very, very much these divisions in our society.
I think that's very interesting, because if you look at this period, right, up till the 70s, you have sort of 3 external wars. You have, at that point in time, a drought, you have floods, you have Indira Gandhi going out and trying to find resources to help feed the people, particularly the refugees who are were pouring in from East Bengal at that point. And I can see why there's a lot of even more pessimism during the 70s, particularly after the emergency. And it's very interesting when you think of, you know, the build up to the 90s, when you think of the Sikh riots, or you think of sort of the communal divisions that are easily stoked by political leaders up to that point. So I think the thing about the constitution is that it promises a lot.
Yes.
And therefore, that's sort of what we hold our political leaders accountable by. Whenever, you know, it's what you call in, like, public policy, the principal agent problem, right? You say, oh, this was your duty as a public servant. And by not acting by the rules of the constitution, you're not acting as my representative. And I think that's very interesting in how it plays out during that period. So what changes in the 90s with liberalization? What fundamentally changes with India's identity?
So at post-liberalization, we have a report now for 2010. And we definitely see a lot more optimism. For the first time, when we look at, you know, the top 5 or 10 identities of India in 2010, whereas previously the majority of the main identities were more negative, things that we have to get rid of from Indian society, we now have a shift towards more optimistic, positive and aspirational identities. And so, you know, with the whole India Shining narrative, we see that, you know, Indians are now taking pride in their educated people, in the creativity and talent of Indians. We're still very concerned about divisions in society due to caste and religion. And we're still very, very unhappy with the state of our leadership. You know, political leaders are corrupt, bureaucracy is inefficient, but nearly 2 decades of solid economic growth and liberalizing reforms has definitely lent the country a whole bunch of optimism and a positive self-conception.
Okay. So I think the 2010s are also very interesting, because at that point in time is when you have, the idea of India as a rising power coming up. India also, I think, postures itself as that on the international stage. It's when we sign the Indo-US nuclear deal.
Right.
And therefore relations with the US get much better.
Yes.
So what do you think of national identity and foreign affairs in that sense, particularly about, like, our major relationships with Pakistan, with China, with the United States? How does that play out?
So in India's imagination, some countries have loomed really, really large in almost every single year. The Soviet Union was important in India's self-conceptions as a significant other. until at least 1990. So after 1990, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, that, you know, our relationship with them has become a little bit less important. The fact that the Soviet model fails is also, you know, it contributes to a sort of a re-examination of India's own socialist identity. And so, you know, when we talk about economic identity, so far I've, you know, spoken about how important the developing country and the poverty identities are. And, you know, by 2010, the emphasis has shifted to economic growth. We're still a poor country, but we're growing and we need to keep growing. So that shift in the emphasis happens. But the other, you know, transition in economic identities that we see is that until the 1970s, 80s, socialism is very important. And we understand that in terms of not communism, but redistributive socialism. And we seem to value this idea of having a planned economy and where the state is sort of intervening more in the economy. And so socialism understood in that way as democratic socialism is still sort of important. But after 1990s, there is a more re-questioning of, well, is that really suitable? We've tried that for many decades and it's not working. And the U.S. and the West with their capitalistic model have succeeded. And so capitalism becomes a little bit more important in India's economic identities. And with that, you know, the U.S. starts playing a bigger role in the other countries that we talk about. And we've always been ambivalent towards the United States. We identify with them because they're also a secular democracy, and especially because they are a plural society, right? America was fundamentally a country of immigrants. People from anywhere and everywhere could move to America and, you know, have their shot at gaining the American dream. And that's something that's, you know, always captured the imagination of Indians. We admire their economic success and their, you know, scientific progress. We admire all of that. But we've also never been afraid of criticizing American foreign policy. And that's been, you know, very, very strong sort of force in our own foreign relations with the U.S. as well. At the same time, in certain sections of society, there has always been this concern, you know, to what extent is going towards the West and sort of westernization a threat to our own culture? So we've always, you know, had a more sort of ambivalent attitude towards the United States. Pakistan, of course, has been important since day one. It plays a very important role in how India understands itself. And no doubt it's the same on the other side of the border. But for India's, you know, self-identity, we think about it in the sense that we are secular, they are theocratic. We are democracy, but they keep succumbing to military dictatorships. And they sponsor terrorism and extremist violence in India. You know, so Pakistan, of course, plays a central role in our self-imagination. China's more interesting. Our perception of China has changed over the years. Even in 1970, there was a lot of sympathy in India for China because of the shared colonial past, right? So China had to suffer its century of humiliation, and we identified with them because of our own experience with British colonialism. And, you know, 1962 war definitely damaged relations, and we blamed India's political leadership for losing that war. But this has changed. And already by 1990, we see that, you know, in India's imagination, China starts being seen as an instigator of separatist movements in India's northeast. And then over time, you know, they're moving closer to Pakistan geopolitically. And by 2010, China has definitely emerged as a competitor, as a rival for power in Asia. And the other aspect is also, you know, in the discourses, the popular discourses, we still, you know, pride ourselves for being a democracy, whereas China is authoritarian. So these kind of, I think these underlying narratives, perceptions about ourselves in relation to others definitely do help us understand some of the underlying forces that move relations between states.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. With, for example, with the US, you also have a lot of Indian migrants who go to the US and have a lot of success there. And they sort of become symbols back home, right, of this Indian exceptionalism, that Indians are talented naturally and hardworking and smart. And that goes back to our culture and our civilizational identity. So that's very interesting when I think about relations with the US. With Pakistan, it's always sort of like, oh, we're the better version. You know, if things go wrong here, like, that's what we would have ended up as. And you would think that there would sort of be a note of censure in there. I mean, I'd like to talk about that maybe when we're talking more about sort of like fundamentalism and Hindutva, maybe. But that's very, very interesting. With China, I always find India's perception and Indians' perceptions of China interesting, because you have very few people who've gone, who've lived and who've engaged with China as closely as you would see in other countries. You have lots of accounts of Indians living in Russia, for example, or the USSR during the Cold War, but China still remains alien. And therefore, I find it interesting about how people either say, oh, we should be like China in that they are efficient and they get things done. And we don't, and we're fundamentally messy and inefficient and chaotic in that sense. And so I think it'll be very interesting to see your data set for 2020.
Yes.
Actually, because at this point in time, are we a rising power? Yeah. Are we an emerging power? Can we actually compete with China?
Right.
Would we like to compete with China?
All of those
What
anxieties.
Are our positions, you know, towards the US with Pakistan? I think, like, from a geopolitical perspective, those are very fascinating questions.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, you mentioned this whole that, you know, we should be like China because they're so efficient, right? And we see, like, what, a month ago they built an entire hospital in 10 days. And can you imagine something like that happening in India? So there is definitely, you know, I think some attraction in among Indians for that kind of a strong leader model. At the same time, you know, very often it becomes an excuse. Well, yeah, you know, of course things are slow in India and a little bit inefficient, but that's because we're a democracy. And of course, I mean, wouldn't you rather be democratic and have some sacrifice a little bit of efficiency in exchange for freedoms and liberties and rights? So that's an interesting dynamic that you see. But also, considering how foreign China is for the common person, I always find it fascinating that Chinese food is street food in India. Right? So, I mean, we have our own Chinese cuisine, which is nothing like Chinese food in India, but oh my God, it's delicious.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm a sucker for gobi manchurian any day, right? Like, even when I'm living in China, some of my friends are like, oh, like, you know, what do you think of Chinese food? And I'm like, it's great. It's nothing like Indian Chinese
food. Come and try Indian Chinese one.
Like, you should really come and try Indian Chinese food, right? Because it's fascinating. And just a tangent, but, like, I was reading about how everywhere the Chinese food sort of travels to, it becomes localized to the tastes there. And then it's very weirdly the cheapest food that exists
there. It is,
And this is not only true for India, but it is around the world as well. And over the last couple of years, sort of Chinese food is gaining in stature the same way Japanese food is.
Yeah.
But I think that's still very interesting. I always tell my Chinese friends, I'm like, you should come to India and taste the interpretation of Chinese food.
Show me in India streets.
All right. So this is something that I essentially wanted to get to when we're talking about India's national identity. And that's basically about how we think about the rise of Hindutva.
Yeah.
Essentially, over the last few weeks, for example, you see a pogrom that's being carried out in Delhi. And before that, you have protests against the Citizenship Amendment Bill and the National Registry of Citizens. But what it's fundamentally resulted in now is the killing and looting of Muslim people and property. And you would think that for a country that's been through riots before in 84, in 91, in 2002, that we've learned better. But this seems to prop up every single time. So what does national identity tell us about the rise of Hindutva?
So a few things. The first point is, you know, so there's always many different identities in society. And in India's identity discourses, there's always been a tension between communalism and secularism. Mm. Right? So we self-identify very strongly as simultaneously being communal but also secular. We value secularism. It's an important part of our identity. And we get it, you know, we talk about it in relation to our constitution and the preamble and, you know, that understanding of India's democracy. And we've always rejected communalism. It's something that's a great evil and we need to get rid of it. But at the same time, even among secular liberals, there is a sense that minorities in India, especially the Muslims, will complain no matter what. Mm. And so, you know, this discourse, it uses the constitutionally guaranteed equality to emphasize that and to say that, you know, they use this when you are equal and when there is this entire system of reservations that has been constructed to, you know, promote minorities in the country. They use this to delegitimize or question the discrimination that minorities, especially Muslims, might face in their everyday lived experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's always, we see these examples when we're reading the discourses that they'll point to the few people who are in positions of power in the mm-hmm. country, right? Well, we've had presidents that are Muslim. So how can you claim that Muslims are facing discrimination?
Which is sort of the equivalent of saying, oh, like I have one friend
yes.
who is from a different race and yeah. therefore I cannot be racist, right? Yeah. We've had a president who is Muslim and therefore how could we be communal?
I mean, it's the same thing as saying that, yeah, you know, we've had a woman prime minister and we've had women presidents. Mm. So how can women be facing discrimination yeah, in yeah, Indian yeah. society, right? So these kinds of arguments have always been part of our discourse where we're grappling with what does it, you know, mean to value secularism in mm-hmm. such a deeply communal society. The other thing, you know, is that politicians have always made full use of communalism to win votes. Mm. And this is, again, you know, people are very aware of this. People see through this. Mm. It's interesting that when it comes to voting, then, you know, we still end up with the kind of government we have in power today. But the fact that our politicians never hesitate to make use of these kinds of divisions in Indian mm-hmm. society is a very, very big factor for why Indians have been disillusioned with politicians right from 1950. Right? So the sense of disillusionment that we have with our political class, that yes, they're corrupt and yes, they're ineffective, but the other big reason for the disillusionment is that they make use of communal and caste divisions mm. in Indian society for their political benefit. Mm. And this is something that, you know, people, especially in the novels that we read, people reject this kind of thing. Mm. This is something that makes people very angry. It contributes to a cynicism for Indian politics more generally. And it also affects how much stake people seem to have in democracy.
Mm. I think that's very interesting because I think the current government in power, this was one of their biggest narratives when they came to power in 2014.
Yes.
And this seems to be a narrative that's percolated to the majority
yeah.
right now, right? That you had sort of, you had 70 years of
yes.
minority rule and therefore, you know, there's no longer any discrimination against minorities
yeah.
in this country and everybody is equal. And so
yeah.
it's been achieved. And therefore, we no longer need reservations. We no longer need quotas. We no longer need to keep in mind that people have different experiences than ours because, you know, we all sort of now face the same issues.
Yeah.
It's sort of been one narrative, one political narrative
yeah.
that's been peddled for a reason.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of these narratives, like even this Hindutva narrative has been around, always been around,
yeah.
right? It goes back at least 100 years, if not more. I think the difference is that in our data set, we don't find that it is widespread enough to count as a part of our identity. So in thinking about, you know, what discourses are widespread enough in Indian society that we can treat them as elements of our national identity, secularism has, until now at least, been far more widespread than any sort of Hindutva ideology might be. And I think what contemporary politics suggests is that after simmering in Indian society for decades, Certainly, as a counter discourse to secularism, which is more widespread, Hindutva has finally broken out into the open. Mm. It's come out into the mainstream. And so what remains to be seen is, of course, how widespread Hindutva has become today. Mm. Maybe it has become more widespread. Maybe it is the case of, you know, an extremely vocal minority.
Mm.
But I want to also sort of talk about, you know, what enabled this to become so mainstream, right? Mm. Like, how did Hindutva break out into the mainstream? Mm. And this goes back to two common themes in India's identity narratives. One is the disillusionment with politics, and the other is the concern with corruption, mm. right? And what we see is, you know, that, of course, a lot of people who voted for the BJP did so because they believe in their brand of Hindu nationalism. Mm. There are plenty of people who supported the Ram Janma Bhoomi mm. and Mandir Yahi Banayenge, and the fact that, you know, we need a strong government that can put Pakistan in its place. So mm. in 2014, when people went to polls for BJP, a lot of these kinds of people voted for them.
There's also sort of an other camp that says that, you know, we should use technology and we should yes. be developed, but at the same time, we shouldn't lose the essence of Indian
yes.
culture.
Yes.
So we should be taking Western technology, but not Western
Correct.
Values.
And so
sense.
All of this is, like, you know, very, very part of the, you know, the RSS sort of worldview, right? Mm. This is part of that. And a lot of voters for BJP subscribe to that worldview. But I think a lot more people, sort of more moderates, mm. Centrist liberals also voted for the BJP, especially mm. in the elections last year, perhaps. And I think, you know, one big reason for that is the disillusionment with Indian politics mm. and the corruption.
Mm.
And India has been disillusioned with its political class since 1950.
Yeah.
And successive Congress governments did not do anything to change that disillusionment. Mm. And if we look at the last UPA government, the, you know, the decade-long rule that they had, the staggering scale of corruption.
Mm.
And so, you know, between the corruption and between how much decay has set into the Congress mm. as a party, where it just, it's basically failing to provide any kind of leadership. Mm. Even today, with, you know, so much happening in Delhi right now, what is Congress's leadership? So a lot of people voted for the BJP because it seemed as an end to corruption, as an end to government inefficiency, because mm. they promised to end, you know, reduce red tape, to use technology and to bring growth and development. And so a lot of people voted not for Hindutva, but they voted for the promise mm. of economic growth, of less corruption, as more efficiency, as mm. being better for business.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's something that stands out. I remember around 2014 having conversations with family, and at that point of time they were saying, yeah, you know, like, the BJP is problematic, but, like, look at the number of times parliament has functioned.
Yes.
Like, you have nothing that happens
yes.
because, like, coalition governments simply don't work
yeah.
anymore. And it's very interesting in that sense because, you know, about 7 years from then, you have the parliament functioning at an even lower level
yes.
than it did back during
yeah.
the UPA regime. And so I don't know if this is sort of like the cyclical nature of Indian politics. But as you said, the lack of a credible opposition is something that stands out in Indian politics
yes.
from sort of the 90s onwards
Correct.
Almost, right? And I think that's one of the reasons why people wanted to vote in change.
Yeah.
And that's understandable
yeah.
in that sense.
And I mean, the sad thing is, you know, I don't see that situation, the lack of opposition, changing. You
mm.
know, we've exchanged Congress for BJP today mm. in the sense of who's running from the center. But where is the opposition? The Congress is no longer an opposition
yeah.
that can be expected to provide any sort of leadership. And I don't see the party engaging in any sort of self-reflection
mm.
Or any serious consideration of, you know, how it can change itself to respond to the political needs of the country today.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think particularly in the last couple of weeks,
yeah.
you see that standing out. And when
yeah.
you look at the opposition in the parliament right now is regional parties,
yeah.
right? You don't even have the Congress
yeah.
playing a major role there. And even if it is just political rhetoric, even if they don't really have representation in the parliament. The Congress has a political legacy and yes. they have resources that yes. they could mobilize. Yes. And I think that's something that's frustrated a lot of yes. people over the last couple of years.
And especially, you know, the much maligned liberal secular class in India today, right? I think they still remember the leadership that Congress leaders of the past provided. Mm. Where, I mean, think about, you know, all the dharnas and the hunger fast and the marches that were organized by past Congress leaders, especially in the freedom struggle, if we think about that. Where is that today? I mean, has any Congress leader organized any kind of dharna in outside parliament or in Delhi? Like, why are they not, you know, speaking out? Because they were, I mean, if we're going to be honest about it, the government that we had after independence, this is the idea of creating a liberal, secular, democratic India very much goes back to a lot of leaders who were part of the Congress. And so it is that very idea of India which is under attack today. And I am just really disappointed that today's Congress leadership doesn't seem to care that that idea of India is under attack.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm also disappointed just at the state of politics. When you yeah. when you first said that, like, you know, there is disillusionment with the political class, I think that's something that I really just identify with. But then I remember that I also have the privilege of just being disillusioned, yeah. right, at the end of the day. Being an academic, I have the privilege to sort of take a step back and yeah. Be able to analyze this from sort of like a clinical perspective. But because it doesn't directly affect me if I live in South yeah. Delhi. And I was actually talking to a couple of my friends from this over the last week. I said, this is extremely dystopian.
It is.
That people are still in bars and in bookshops yeah. and chilling and celebrating and continuing on with their lives as normal. And I think that's sort of normalized now.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, this entire thing about, you know, communal violence is so normalized in India, though, right? And even the last few days, we've had political leaders who've gone and actually made statements that, yeah, this kind of stuff keeps happening in India. Mm. So what? And, you know, it's become habitual that, yeah, we have riots, people die, and then we move on. And doesn't matter how corrupt the government is or how inefficient the bureaucracy is, India has managed to muddle through for, you know, however many decades, and we will continue muddling through.
Yeah. But do you think sort of the nature of Hindutva is different in that sense? Because unlike ever before, now you have social media, and it's yeah. so easy to peddle hate on social yeah. media. And I think, you know, if you just go onto Twitter, you'll be able to see the amount of diverse opinions yeah. on everything. So even people who disagree, even people who agree with the program that this is, don't have a fundamental answer or idea on how you could coordinate or how you could coalesce to sort of help.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how different this is. I think it certainly serves to sort of amplify these kinds of voices, right? But think about how the Sangh Parivar has operated for, you know, the last 90 years or something, where they have just an amazing grassroots network where they've been working in their shakhas for decades. And they've created a kind of machinery, you know, they've spread their ideology in society over decades and decades and decades. And I don't think any other party in India or any other, you know, political group has done something of that level. And yeah, we're seeing all of this come out in social media now, but this was always there. You know, this was always there in towns and villages. Like, of course, none of this was ever happening in South Delhi. And so, you know, or Central Delhi. And so the political establishment at the center could ignore it easily. But this has been happening for decades. They've been training people to defend Indian culture and, you know, to make India strong. The kind of militant training that happens in these places of not just young men, but also young women. I think all of this is getting amplified, but I'm not sure it's new.
Yeah, I think maybe what's new is that this idea of Hinduism as a monotheistic religion that is coming up, right? And so you will still have your plenty of gods. But earlier, I think you had maybe a more liberal Hinduism as compared to a more illiberal Hinduism, which is now morphed into Hindutva. And so, therefore, that's why your family WhatsApp groups are filled with, like, hate from people who go, oh, all these years I could not be proud that I was a Hindu, and now I can admit that it is part of my identity.
Yeah.
And you sort of have space for that, because people's political identities and social identities maybe didn't have that space before.
Maybe. I mean, it's also, you know, what the right wing has been very good about doing is crafting this this discourse that Hinduism is not just a religion, it's a civilization.
It's a way of life.
It's a way of life. It's not religion. It's much broader, you know, it's culture. And it's you know, everybody who has ever lived in this great land is Hindu by default, because this is just this land, and it sort of, and so they use it to claim even that, yeah, so what? You might be practicing religion, Islam or Christianity or whatever, but culturally, everybody can be Hindu. And so that is a really insidious way of packaging this entire...
And then you have sort of your soft Hindutva, right?
Yeah.
Which is people like spiritual gurus, like Satguru, and peddling sort of pseudoscience and ideas that are just fake.
It's incredible to me that these people are getting as much, you know, as big a platform today where they're being taken seriously. And especially, you know, forget the divisive religious or political discourse that they're peddling. At a basic level, they're just, they're peddling falsehoods, right? They're peddling really superstitious and backward ideas about the place of women in society.
Very regressive about women's clothing.
Extremely regressive.
About Ayurveda, for example, during the coronavirus. I constantly got forward words, particularly when I was in China, about how rasam cures coronavirus, about how homeopathy works, you know. It's, it's, it was very incredulous, and at that point in time, just frustrating to me, you know, that, like, you would think that any of this works. It's also dangerous, on a fundamental level, to believe that homeopathy cures coronavirus.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because, of course, if you grow up in India, you grow up eating homeopathic medicines, right? And don't get me wrong, I love those little beads of sugar, because they sugar, why not? But even today, you know, my parents would be like, yeah, you know, we have a little cold or a little headache, and we've got this homeopathic medicine, and try explaining this to them, right? That this doesn't work, and people just don't want to listen. And it's interesting that we've always aspired to be a modern, scientific, educated nation. And what's happening again today, we're seeing this understanding of what it means to be scientific being undermined, where you're having scientific conferences where they are talking about Vedic science, right? Or you have ministries that are funding research into the benefits, medicinal benefits of cow urine. That's just, that's, I mean...
It's a waste of resources.
It's a waste of resources. Do you know how much money, like, Indian scholars make? Like, what a PhD's salary is here? The fact that we have no funding or institutional support to participate in the global knowledge industry, which, let's be honest, it is an industry, and it requires a lot of financial capital and institutional support to be a part of the global knowledge industry. And we're just not able to compete in that because resources are going in absolutely ridiculous directions.
And that's what's interesting, right? Because to me, this also shows how you sort of have multiple identities. So even if you are an educated, and by that I mean like you have a bachelor's or a master's or a PhD in something scientific, not even say something that's liberal arts, because, you know...
Only dumb people study
liberal arts, right? Like only if you got like below like 60% in your boards would you choose to study the liberal arts. But no, like the idea is you could... be all those things. You could be highly educated, but you could still believe in pseudoscience or prescribe homeopathy or believe that like lunar eclipses are scientifically valid or whatever that was. So, and that's just astounding to me because it means that there is space in our identities for believing in, I don't even know how to characterize this. I don't know what this means for our identities, that all of these things are coming together.
Yeah, I mean, look, identities are always contested, right? It just speaks to the diversity of human experience, that there is always going to be sort of a little bit of conflict between our different identities, and they're not always going to match or fit with each other very, very neatly. But it makes me wonder more about, you know, we look at what's happening in India right now. Has the entire nation building exercise, does it mean that nation building exercise has failed somehow? You know, of what value is an education where you're not able to think critically about the information that's coming this way? If you're not able to weed out what is, you know, what is scientific from what is superstitious, then what is the value of that kind of education? And this is not something that's, you know, India is special or isolated. Like, this is something that we're seeing everywhere in the world right now. Like, look at what's happening in the US politically. Like, the parallels between Indian and American politics right now are very, very sharp. And I don't think this has become so widespread in India right now, but this whole anti-vaccination movement that is extremely popular, increasingly in the US and the UK, at least. I mean, they are the knowledge economy of the world, right? And then they have people who are refusing to vaccinate their kids, and measles is coming back. Like, it's...
I honestly think that anti-vax has hit India. We just don't know.
You think so? Maybe.
Yeah, because I have something called PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, and someone recently told me that that's because it's a reaction to vaccinations.
Oh my God.
And then I tried to tell them that that's just like medically not possible. And so, like, I just took them to, like, the next time I was at a gynecologist, I was like, oh, could you please, like...
No, but don't you know it's because of your cell phone use and eating too much Chinese food?
Sorry, but, like, it's also, like, women these days. Now, they're too feminist to, like, take care of their bodies.
Of
like,
oh, God is angry with you.
It's this modern lifestyle that, like, doesn't agree with me as a woman.
We should all be more Vedic in our culture.
But, you know, it really makes me wonder... How do you sort of reconcile these differences in our identities? Because we all have multiple identities, particularly now, right? In the ecosystem that we're in, we all have echo chambers. Yeah. And I think a lot of people are trying to have difficult conversations with their families, for example, because you have people who are kind and generous, but who are also believing in sort of the fake news or the misinformation that's being peddled around, or, you know, or easily they're buying into Hindutva. Yeah. And so how do you sort of reconcile with those identities? Or on a larger level, what I'm wondering is, are we always going to be communal? Are we always going to be secular? Are we always going to have identities that are at odds with each other and will keep clashing through time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think you can ever not have conflict, right, between identities in society. I think what is important is what we do with that conflict. And the only way to deal with these kinds of disagreements is really through dialogue, right, where we have to be able to sit down and have good faith discussions, right, where both sides are willing to listen to each other and open to changing their minds. Because what's happening right now also is that people are so fixed in their mindset that you're not going to listen to what the other side has to say. But there's also, to me, in the current crisis in India, this is not something where you can have two sides of the debate. Look, when it comes to, you know, economic policy, right, bank rates and loan forgiveness and all of this, there can be differences of opinion about which policy is better for economic growth or which way of redistributing benefits is more conducive to equality in a society. But this issue about the CAA and the NPR and the NRC and the consequences of something like this, if it actually gets implemented, there isn't, you know, two ways to talk about this. when you have a policy that could potentially disenfranchise millions of Indians, when the prospect is of them ending up in detention centers, this is a violation of human rights. And you can't have different but equal opinions on a matter like this. Mm. This is about basic morality, basic respect for human existence. Mm. And so I don't know how you deal with this. How do you, if people don't see that everybody has the equal right to be an Indian citizen, if they don't already believe that, how do you convince them of that? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have any answers. What I will say is that over the last month or two, people reading the preamble of the Constitution,
yes,
is, I think, something that's important. Because
yes,
I think it's important that the Constitution of India never takes a back seat,
yes,
in this democracy.
Yes.
Because the only reason that we have all those values that you spoke,
yes,
at the beginning, independence, freedom, liberty,
yes,
is because the Constitution assures,
yes,
it to us. And I'm extremely, like, disheartened by what's going on with Hindutva and with the pogrom in Delhi. But I'm also hoping that the fact that people are coming on the streets and,
yes,
reading the Constitution is a sign that we will not let Hindutva take away the multiple identities that we will constantly straddle.
Well, we hope. And, you know, again, like, we've always taken pride in our constitution, and we've always looked up to our courts, the high courts and the Supreme Courts especially, for upholding the values of our constitution and the separation of powers, right? We've always taken that as an essential part of our democracy. And the courts are a way of checking the government's overreach. But again, I mean, if you've followed what's happened with just this issue of filing FIRs, mm-hmm, against hate speech in Delhi, with the judge who came out very strongly and was about to ask the Delhi police to file FIRs immediately, he was transferred overnight. And now the new bench has deferred the matter until April. And so one wonders, you know, with the amount of influence that the government has, how independent is our judiciary now? How willing are they to uphold the values of the constitution? Because also with the kind of majority that BJP has in the parliament, I mean, really speaking, what is the way out of the stalemate that we find ourselves, mm-hmm, in over CAA? Right? What is the peaceful way out of this? And the only way seems to be is if the Supreme Court rules it unconstitutional. And I don't know how much faith I have in the Supreme Court today to make a ruling of that sort.
Yeah, I agree. I think when I was thinking about comparing this period to the time of the emergency, for example, is that I look at sort of all the different institutions of the Republic.
Yeah.
And I think a very obvious one is the broadcast media,
mm-hmm,
right? So maybe for your next data set, I'm going to ask you to figure out how you're dealing with biased media resources.
Oh my God, please, I can't
resources.
Watch Arnab Goswami on TV.
Yeah, because it's just, you then have a very polarized media,
yeah,
right? At the time that the pogrom was taking place, I had family messaging me and,
yeah,
saying, I heard that Muslims are setting Hindu houses on fire.
Yes.
Are you okay? And then I said, this is completely not,
yes,
what is happening. This is the reverse. And then I sent them three news articles. And they said, you always keep sending me these leftist,
yes,
news sources, because here are some actual news sources,
yes,
right? And so you have people who are not reading different,
no,
sources of the news. And there are different sources of,
yes,
the same news.
Yes.
So I don't know how to begin thinking about these institutions of democracy.
And, you know, there's the other big problem is just, I'm glad that we have some excellent news sources, alternative news media in India, right? The kind of work that The Wire, News Laundry,
Scroll, Alt News,
like the kind of work that these are doing is so important, especially in today's climate. The problem is, I wonder, most of what they're writing and publishing, even videos that a lot of them are producing, tend to be in English and a little bit of Hindi. And I wonder how wide is their reach among, you know, the vast majority of Indians, you know, who still don't consume English media every day. What, you know, the Hindi speakers in UP or in Haryana or the, you know, regional languages, right? Do we have alternative news sources in different regional languages or not? And this is going to be a big crisis of information in our country.
Yeah, I agree with you. Here's a question. What gives you hope about the national identity in the future?
I think the fact that people are out there protesting right now, that these protests have been going on for how long now? 2 months?
Yeah.
And not just in Delhi, they're happening everywhere in the country. That gives me hope. The fact that people are still standing up for secularism, that we are reading the Constitution, the preamble to the Constitution, and the fact that so many you know, activists are filing cases at various courts to challenge a lot of these rulings, that gives me hope. Because how we understand ourselves is as an independent democracy with constitutionally guaranteed freedoms, which include secularism and equality, these values. And it gives me hope that so many Indians are out on the streets championing these very values today.
Well said. Okay, for someone who's interested in reading more about India's national identity, what books or resources would you recommend?
Well, the best book will be our book, which we're working on. So,
of course.
Watch
of course,
our space.
Undisputed.
No, look, there's a lot of excellent scholarship. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if there is one book that'll give you sort of a comprehensive overview of India's national identities. I think, you know, a lot of people have written very, very insightful works that will help you understand different aspects of India. I mean, you know, Amartya Sen or Ramchandra Guha, Christoph Jaffrelot, like these people have written very insightful works. But apart from that, you know, I am more focused on foreign policy. So I would say that Priya Chacko does some great work on India's post-colonial identity and how that affects India's foreign policy. Sankaran Krishna is another scholar who works on this. Relevant to today's discourses and the crisis in India on communal violence, Ashutosh Varshney has studied this for a very long time. His books, Contested Meanings and Ethnic Conflict and Civic Life, are definitely excellent reads. On citizenship, you know, I would recommend Anupama Roy has Mapping Citizenship in India, which is from 2010. And Nirja Gopal Jayal's book on citizenship and its discontents from 2013. That's an excellent read. On the Constitution, which we value so much, Madhav Khosla's 2012, The Indian Constitution, and one which I am looking forward to beginning in a few days is Rohit De, his book, A People's Constitution, which came out in 2018. And then finally, I will end with a book that helps us understand Hindutva and how that affects Modi's foreign policy. Ian Hall has a wonderful new book, Modi and the Reinvention of Indian Foreign Policy. Just finished reading that, and it's really very, very insightful and approachable analysis of Indian foreign policy under Modi.
All right. That's a good long reading list, I think, for anyone who wants to engage more with this. Thank you so much, Manali. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Amsini. I really enjoyed this talk.
That's it for this episode of States of Anarchy. Manali's book recommendations are attached in the episode description if you want to read more. I really hope that you think about some of the questions about what it means to be Indian and what it means to be secular in India today. If you have any insights, you can reach out to me on Twitter at HamsaniH or on Instagram at States of Anarchy. You can listen to States of Anarchy on the IVM podcast app or any other podcast app where you get podcasts from. We'll see you next time.